This is the UVic Military Oral History Program interview with Lieutenant Colonel Dan Dempsey, recorded on March 18th, 2013, at Mr. Dempsey's house in Victoria, BC. Interviewed by Luke F. Kowalski. Lieutenant Colonel Dempsey, do I have permission to record this interview?
Yes, you do.
Could you please state your name?
Yep, Daniel Vance Dempsey, and Lieutenant Colonel retired.
Okay. So we can start the questions. So we'd like to begin with just some biographical information of yours. Can you tell me your birth date and where you were born?
Yep, I was born in Hamilton, Ontario, on the 28th of November, 1952.
And can you tell me your parents' birthplace?
Yeah, my father was born in Moncton, New Brunswick, and my mother was born in Milestone, Saskatchewan.
And how did they end up in Hamilton?
Sorry?
How did they end up in Hamilton?
My dad was in the RCF at the time. So my dad served 15 years in the RCF, and that's where I first got my exposure to the RCAF and where I gained my, you know, sort of youthful desire to join the Air Force.
And what did your father do in the Air Force?
My dad started off, he was a non-commissioned member. He started off as a supply technician, but within about 2 years had switched into security and eventually rose to the rank of sergeant after 15 years. And at that time was working for the Special Security Investigation Unit in Calgary and in Edmonton. And basically almost like an undercover detective, plainclothes detective at the time.
Wow. And did anybody else in your family have any other military experience?
Just my, I have an uncle, now deceased, but he was a navigator with 432 Bomber Squadron with 6 RCF Group on the Halifax Bomber during World War II. So he flew out of Europe and flew in a number of 1,000 bomber raids and so on and so forth.
So. And so what was his name?
Lloyd Dempsey.
Lloyd Dempsey.
My dad's name was Fred.
Okay. And so did you know your uncle well?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I got to know him quite well. Unfortunately, he passed away quite early, probably around 55 years of age, I would say. But I certainly knew him as a child. Unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to talk to him too much about his RCF career. But I have seen some of the documentation, logbook, and so on and so forth after he had passed away. So I'm still in contact with the rest of his family.
Mm-hmm. It's something that, you know, every other interviewee I've talked to all had, you know, whether a parent or a close relative was in the RCAF. And it's
right.
Interesting to see how they talked about their experiences.
Right, exactly, yeah.
So you obviously mentioned your father's influence, but did you have any other pre-enlistment military interest?
Well, I think my interest in the military really was fostered at a very young age. And it happened to be fostered at the first air show I ever went to, and that was the 6th of June, 1959. Happened to be at RCF Station Rockcliffe in Ottawa, where my dad was posted at the time. And it also happened to be the first air show for the RCF Golden Hawks in Rockcliffe, which at that time was the 50th anniversary of powered flight in Canada. So I was quite mesmerized, even as a six-year-old boy, by the Golden Hawks, by the Red Knight, by all the other aircraft that flew. And back in those days, air shows were just phenomenal in terms of the participation. Just about everything in the Air Force inventory flew, and in some cases in very, very large numbers. From 1960 to 62, for example, they would start the air show with a massive flypast of 38 T-33 aircraft spelling out RCAF. I mean, that was just the start of the show. And then, as I say, everything in the inventory flew. So they were very long air shows, but they were really highly entertaining. So that really, for me, just started the ball rolling, and my interest grew and grew and grew as I grew older through school.
And would you say your interest started there to be a fighter pilot or to be...
Well, I think, you know, the boyhood fantasy, if you will, was to be a pilot like the Golden Hawks and like the Red Knight, to fly air shows.
Yeah.
My interest in flying fighters probably started when I was, you know, sort of a young to middle-aged teenager, when I really saw, you know, the power and the sleekness of fighter aircraft. And certainly my aspirations then were twofold. First of all, to become a fighter pilot and then hopefully someday be good enough to be able to get onto an aerobatic team like the Golden Hawks. And, of course, that turned out to be the Snowbirds.
And Hawk won later on, I
guess. And Hawk won later on, yeah, which is another story, but an interesting adjunct to the story for sure.
All right, so just go back to your biographical information quickly. You mentioned your wife. What year were you married in, and did it have any relation to your Air Force career?
Well, I was actually married in 1978. I joined the Canadian Forces in 1970, and I met my current wife when I was getting towards the end of my flying training in Moose Jaw in 1975, and then we got married in 1978, and I was still in Moose Jaw at the time. So, yeah, and subsequent to that, we had two children, a daughter who was born in Moose Jaw, her name's Stephanie, Stephanie Dempsey Kruger now, and she was born on the 5th of October, 1980, which happened to be the end of my first year on the Snowbirds. And then I had a son born over in Germany when I was flying the CF-104 Starfighter. His name is Jason Daniel Dempsey, and now currently undergoing flying training himself in Portage la Prairie in the RSAF. But he was born in Lahr, West Germany, just down the road from Baden, where I was serving at the time.
All right. So we did talk a bit now about joining the Air Force and your kind of inspiration for it.
Right.
So when did you join the RCAF at first?
Well, first of all, I didn't actually join the RCAF. As you may recall, back in 1968, the three services were disbanded and unification took effect on the 1st of February 1968. So although I'd grown up in the RCAF, when I actually joined the forces, I joined the Canadian Forces, the air element of the Canadian Forces. Now that was in 1970, 2 years after unification. In fact, less than 2 years, because I joined in August of 1970. But anyway, I had applied for it because my focus from a very young age was to try and become a pilot in the Air Force. I thought the best way to do that was to try and get a scholarship, go through military college. We came from a family of six children, so my dad didn't have a lot of money for, you know, university education, so on and so forth. So I just thought that everything told me that if I could get a scholarship to get into the military, get my university education that way, and then become a pilot, that was the best way to go. And fortunately, that's exactly what happened. So I joined in August of 70, came here to Victoria, to Royal Roads Military College at the time. Spent 2 years here, 2 years at RMC in Kingston, Ontario. Graduated with a Bachelor of Science degree. And then eventually went and got my wings in June of 1975 at Moose Jaw.
To me, that seems to be a pretty common narrative now, is that joining the Air Force was a way to get your education and it was a way to get maybe out of where you were in terms of your town.
It's a really great way to go, and I talk to a lot of young people about that very aspect. Those who do aspire to fly, if they have any interest in the military at all, it is a very good way to go. Very competitive, having said that. It's not an easy program to get into, but once you're into it, it is definitely the way to go.
What was your first assignment in the Canadian Forces?
Okay, what I did to start off with was, of course, I finished my training. And back in those days, we all went and did advanced jet training on the CFI fighter at Cold Lake, Alberta. So I went up there and I did the advanced jet course on the F-5, which back in those days was 60 hours, unheard of now for an advanced jet trainer course. And that included, you know, as a young pilot, having the opportunity to fly supersonic and so on and so forth. So it was really a terrific stepping stone. I got selected to come back to Moose Jaw to instruct, as did a number of my compatriots. That was quite common back in those days. There were a few fighter postings, but not that many. So anyway, I went back to instruct in Moose Jaw, and that laid the groundwork, if you will, for one of my aspirations, which was to eventually make the Snowbirds. And so I spent 4 years instructing in Moose Jaw on the Tudor, which the Snowbirds are still flying. And then eventually got a tryout in the fall of 1979 for the Snowbirds and made the team. So that was the first goal achieved.
Yeah, and that answers the did you plan on ending up in demonstration flying question.
Yeah, absolutely. It was something that was really a very, very strong desire I had to at least have had the opportunity to try. And again, being selected for a tryout, we'll get into this a little bit later, being selected for a tryout is not easy. And there's no guarantee once you are selected, because they normally select double the number of guys you're going to select. So if you're picking four new pilots for the team, eight people get tryouts. So you got a 50-50 chance.
All right. So as an officer with lots of public relations experience working with the snowbird and demonstrations teams, we'll just kind of move on to topics about general RCAF public relations throughout your career, I guess Canadian Forces, Air Arm, and RCAF. And if you just help me to understand the importance of public relations to the RCAF.
I think public relations are really, really important. And I think you can say in any Western democracy, when you have people who are generally attuned to what their country is doing, in terms of foreign relations, in terms of their own militaries, a lot of people, not all for sure, but a lot of people are very interested in where budgets are being spent, for example. And that's certainly a characteristic of Western society. And I think that people deserve to know how their money is being spent and be reassured that their money is being well spent. So that's where public relations come in. And the public relations are both to inform and to educate people as to what their military represents, what the mandate of the military is, where the money is going and why it's going there, and why we may or may not be involved with various conflicts or relationships that are going on around the world. And so I think public relations within the RCF and indeed within the entire Canadian Armed Forces is extremely important.
And do you feel the RCF does enough public relations work?
I think they do. I think there's always room for improvement. I think that, you know, one of the challenges that you have now with all three aspects of the Canadian Forces is that we've shrunken significantly in size, and as a result, you perhaps don't have the same strength in numbers of public relations personnel that you once had in the military. They tend to be stretched out pretty thin. They have a very important mandate. But I think it'd be fair to say also that, especially with the modern-day social media, with internet, for example, which would be the key one, the information is there. And if people want the information, they can generally find it. And certainly, the public relations network in the Canadian Forces, and obviously including the RCF, is wide open. People can write in, they can phone, they can do whatever they want, and eventually they will get an answer. So I think the mechanisms are there.
Something I've learned in my research is that it is, you know, you can go onto the RCF website or any DND website and access every journal and article that's put out. And I found that really interesting, and an enlightening experience or an eye-opening experience.
And also the fact that not only have we come a long way in providing that information, but remember, there's a tremendous effort and cost in making all that information bilingual. So you can get it in English equally in French. Mm-hmm. And that, I think that says a lot for the system.
Okay, so just briefly, in your experience, what do you feel are the main strategies the RCAF employs in PR?
Well, I think the RCAF tries to reach out as much as they possibly can. But I think you have to also remember that unless people go searching for the information, it's very much dependent. For example, when it comes to the media, information can be provided to the media, but if the media doesn't like the story, doesn't think it's going to be of interest to the readers or the people on television, they don't use it. And so I dare say that there are a lot of public relations releases that go out about the RCAF, Canadian Forces operations, that people never see unless they're searching for it, because the media simply doesn't print it. And on the negative side, you'll often find, and then there are certainly examples in modern day examples right now, where the media will take a subject and sensationalize it. You know, you're always going to be faced with this. We always have been. There's always going to be good media, and there's going to be media that's put in a negative light. I particularly find that frustrating sometimes, because I think that people who do that don't necessarily understand exactly the topic they're talking about or why they're doing it. They're doing it more to get a newspaper story out as opposed to the quality of the information.
And so do you feel that the RCF image is almost more formed by the media rather than the RCA.
In some respects, for sure. And again, it all depends on the individual that that you're talking about. For the average layman in the streets, who isn't necessarily thinking about the Canadian forces and the roles of the Canadian forces and so on and so forth, the image they get of the military will be largely what they read in the press, whether it's good or bad. And I think that's unfortunate because, most things that I found in my experience of the military, and I've been involved with the military since, 1970 and certainly beyond, I think most things you can say about the military are very positive. Sure, there are negative examples. There always will be. But most of the stuff from the military, in my experience, is very positive.
Right. So, in your opinion, do you feel the public knows what the RCAF does?
I think those who want to know do know. I think there's sufficient information out there that that people can get that information if they want it. If they don't, if the military does not interact with their day-to-day schedule, a lot of people don't even think about the military. You know, we have the good fortune of living in a country that's never been attacked. So we don't have the same viewpoint in our society in Canada, or the United States for that matter, that a European would. You know, you go talk to someone who lived through World War II in England or the Netherlands or Belgium or any of those countries, and Germany for that matter, they have a totally different perspective on military forces and the importance of those military forces because of what they endured or what their fathers and forefathers endured.
So, once again, as a man with lots of experience in this area, can you detail some important public relations moments from your own Air Force career?
Sure. I mean, you could probably name any number of examples, but obviously one that, from my own particular career, I guess, would be back to the Gulf War in 1991. At that time, I had just finished my tour with the Snowbirds as commanding officer of the Snowbirds. I had been selected by the chief of the air staff, by the commander of Air Command, to become his executive assistant. So I was in that position on day one of the first Gulf War. Now, there was an example where we, as a member of an alliance, the government of Canada, decided that we were going to go into combat operations. Initially, it was defensive operations, and later on went to offensive operations. So we had F-18s in theater. What they were doing initially was combat air patrol, which was a defensive scenario, if you will. Mm-hmm. And later on, because NATO needed the extra attack forces, we did convert into conventional ground attack for part of that conflict. That was a prime case, and certainly was front page news and on the news just about every single day of the importance of generating for the Canadian public why we were doing this as a country, and why we were doing it as a member of this alliance, and so on and so forth. So that's one example. There have been lots of other examples where Canada has decided, well, Afghanistan is another one. We didn't have fighter forces in Afghanistan, but we certainly had tactical helicopter forces over there, which were doing a very, very important job. We eventually even went to the extreme, because our troops needed it, of getting some Chinook helicopters, which weren't required by the U.S. Army, and having Canadian pilots fly those Chinook helicopters in support of our own troops. These are all things that now become, when you talk about armed conflict, they become very big budget items because they're not forecast. You always have a bit of a contingency fund, but you never can possibly anticipate what the cost might be if you actually have to go into war. And certainly the costs of because of the location of those conflicts, the costs of the first Gulf War, and even more so the Afghanistan War for Canada, were very, very large for the size of our country and our gross national product. Those are just examples where public relations really now become acute, because people need and should know what's going on with the military at that point.
And I'm sure it's tempting now to get into the F-35 debate, but hopefully we can save that for later.
Yeah, sure. I'd be happy to address that later. Yeah. I think it's an important important discussion point for sure.
Okay, so I'd like to move on to air shows now.
Sure.
And kind of probe you for a little information on them, and then particularly we'll move on to the Snowbirds later on as a unit in themselves. So, can you help me to understand what the RCAF's main motives are in attending and supporting air shows in Canada?
Well, I think the reality is that when you look at an air show as a concept, there is no other medium in our entire nation where you can expose the Canadian forces to a larger population than an air show. For a couple of reasons. Number one, they're very popular. People love air shows. Millions of people go to air shows. And number two, air shows are mobile. Because airplanes fly, because we can fly to every corner of Canada, including the north, it's easy to reach out to people right across Canada, in every community, large and small. And certainly the Snowbirds, for example, have done that for many, since the beginning, for the last 42 years. The Snowbirds have done that. They performed in every region, including the far north of the country. So it's an easy way for the Canadian Armed Forces to get out there in front of the public and show them what their military is all about. And the other thing that I think is really important here is that when we're talking about air shows, we're not just talking about the RSAF. It is an opportunity for the entire Canadian Forces to get in front of the public. For example, you'll go to air shows, lots and lots of air shows now, where if there is an Army component or an Army base nearby, the Army will be there in full force. They'll have their jeeps, their tanks, their field guns or whatever they happen to have in the area, or reserve units. They'll be there to allow people to see what they do as well. And similarly, the Navy obviously can't be in the center of Canada, but they can certainly have personnel there. Recruiting units will always be there. There will always be people there to answer the questions. So it's just a natural medium for the Canadian Forces to publicize what they do. But there's another side to it, and I can get into that right now, and I think it's important. The opportunity to demonstrate the skill, the professionalism, and teamwork of the Canadian Forces is also an opportunity, and I've seen this so many times, to inspire young people. Mm-hmm. And they don't have to be inspired to join the military. They're just inspired to see something that is so fantastic, so entertaining, something that young people, perhaps their own age, have achieved, that it's an inspiration for them to go out and perhaps try and better their lives. And that's been one of my big themes since I've been in this business, is to really try and inspire young people to do something special.
And just, with the commercial aspects of the bigger shows, so when the RCAF attends a private show, is it still the same kind of idea as to, to just demonstrate the skill and professionalism of the RCAF?
Sure, it is. It always will be, no matter what form it is. Remembering that, there will be some the odd private show, but not very many. Most air shows are public air shows. Remember that those who sponsor air shows, in terms of commercial companies and so on and so forth, they want the biggest bang for their buck too, because whether you're whoever, Kodak or whatever company you happen to be, and there will often be a large number of sponsors to make these things work. They will all want to have the opportunity to demonstrate, or at least show off their name as well and their product at these shows. So the more the merrier in terms of, the number of people, the number of sponsors that are involved.
And I suppose I don't have to ask you, do you feel so? Why do you feel air shows and demonstration teams are such an effective PR tool?
Simply because, as I said, because you can reach out to so many people. And there's another aspect to it as well. And I saw this when I was a young boy, when I was motivated to join the RCAF, the Air Force, because of the Golden Hawks. There's something special about watching something that is really unique. Now remember that most people in Canada who love to go to air shows might get to one air show a year. The real fanatics might get to two or three, and some people will travel a long distance to go to an air show. And I've seen this many times in my career. But there's something special about going to see a person in uniform that's doing something so unique, because you can live vicariously through that individual. Whether it's the F-18 demonstration pilot doing this phenomenal show in the Hornet, or whether it's the beauty and the grace of a snowbird show. They inspire people. And so for me, it's such a natural thing, and that's why I think they're so important. I think it's one of the most important things we do in the Canadian Forces, because, as I said, you can reach out to every corner of the country. And it doesn't really matter, when you talk about the snowbirds, it doesn't matter whether the team is performing in front of 200 people in the north or a million people in a big American show, which we've done many, many times. The show is the same. The interaction with the people is the same. The motivation is the same. The mandate is the same. And that's a pretty cool thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I did shows in the Canadian north where it was the highlight of their year. Snowbirds coming to town.
And everybody from all over the area comes in.
Shut down the town. Shut down the entire town for the day, close the schools so they can come out and watch the snowbirds. Yeah, absolutely.
So, obviously, the response from the public to the RCF at air shows is overwhelmingly good in your experience.
Absolutely. I can't say enough about it. And, I mean, you know, you never have access to this sort of stuff because it's not something that's sort of put on the internet or anything. But if you could just see the hundreds and hundreds of letters that the snowbirds, for example, get every year, or indeed that you know, that the Minister of National Defence may get, which certainly comes into play when you're doing shows south of the border. You know, when you're going outside the confines of Canada to do a show down the United States, for example, they're very passionate about that sort of thing. And they don't hesitate to write letters of thanks and appreciation and so on and so forth to really applaud what we do as a nation. I just, for example, just to digress very slightly, I just did a presentation at the Palm Springs Air Museum in California just a week ago. And that entire day was dedicated to the Canadian Armed Forces in Palm Springs, California. I've never seen that in my experience where it wasn't an air show. It was two guest speakers, myself and Bill March, who is an Air Force historian, presently living in Trenton, Ontario. But we were down there to promote the Canadian Armed Forces. And in Bill's case, he was talking about the RCF involvement in the Second World War. And I was talking about post-war and sort of encompassing what we've done in the air show industry, because the snowbirds are very, very popular down in the United States. But that's just one example that just really... really impressed me that they would go to this length, and this is the seventh year in a row they've done that.
Huh. Yeah. And what was the response from the people in attendance?
Fantastic. It was standing room only. Wow. You know, it was standing room. It was really well received.
So to go back to that question, so with all the tons of positive response, did you have any negative response to everyday air shows? And this might fall later under criticism of air shows. But
yeah, okay. Sure. I mean, you always will have some. There's no question. Air shows are noisy. First of all, they're always going to generate noise complaints. And a prime case would be, for example, you really have a mixed bag in Toronto. You know, Toronto, the Canadian International Air Show, happens to be Canada's senior air show. Well, every year the air show is tremendously popular for those who like air shows, and it's tremendously unpopular for those who don't like the noise associated with the shows. And that's understandable. I mean, we live in a free country, and people are, you know, obviously can express their opinions. I think the pros far outweigh the cons, myself.
And probably the positives outweigh the negatives.
For sure. In my view, absolutely. But you will find people that you will never convince that air shows or airports, in some cases, you know, where they may be living, are a good thing.
Yeah.
So that's just the way it goes.
So have you noticed a significant change in air show practice and maybe methods or just the kind of the course they take over the course of your career?
Yeah, I have. And unfortunately, some of it was created totally outside of our control in Canada and the United States. But there was a big change in the way air shows are conducted or the rules under which they're conducted. In Europe in 1988 because of a tragedy in Ramstein with the Italian team, the Frecce Tricolori, when they had a mid-air collision that resulted in an aircraft going into the crowd and killing a whole bunch of people. That was an atrocious, terrible accident that should never have happened, but it did. And as a result, even though our rules in Canada were much more stringent, they became even more stringent to ensure that that kind of an accident can never happen in North America. Well, can't say never, but should never happen in North America.
Was that not probably 2 years ago with the P-51 crashed somewhere in the States?
Yeah, well, that was, remember, that was different, though. That was the Reno Air Races.
Okay.
That was not an air show. That was an air race. That was a competitive air race being flown by extremely highly modified P-51 Mustang by a relatively old pilot. And unfortunately, they had modified the aircraft to the extent that they had a malfunction that he could not overcome and was unexpected. And he ended up getting blacking out and probably killed because of the onforce of the sudden G when the component of the tail failed, probably killed him in the cockpit. And yes, there were people killed there for sure. But I think there's an important distinction there
between
an air race, which is a competition, and an air show, which is a demonstration of specialized skills and talent. Big difference. Mm-hmm. But you're right. For many people, the effect would be the same because there were spectators watching.
Obviously, there's a dangerous aspect to it.
Well, you know, that's a good point. And I'm glad you raised that point. I have never, ever considered my involvement with air shows to be dangerous. Either when I was doing head-on aerobatics with my partner in the first 2 years, or when I was leading the snowbirds. And the reason for that is because the snowbirds do not do, and nor, I think I can safely say, nor would any professional aerobatic team would never deliberately do something that is considered to be dangerous. The snowbirds, the thunderbirds, the blue angels, the red arrows, to name a few, the western, you know, very famous military aerobatic teams, are not daredevils. Never have been, never will be. A lot of people, you'll see in the press, you know, daredevils do this, daredevils. They are not daredevils. A daredevil does a maneuver where the outcome is dubious or questionable. The professional military aerobatic teams never do anything that is dubious. It is practiced to the nth degree, hundreds and hundreds of times before it's ever done in front of the public. Sure, there's an element of risk, but the element of risk that you have in a professional military aerobatic team is the less than the element of risk I have from driving from here to downtown Victoria. And that I guarantee.
You can't practice that, yes, every day.
Exactly. You can't practice that, you hang on for dear life. Yeah.
So, in your time with the Snowbirds, what were some of the key differences you noticed between Canadian and American shows, or was there any?
Yeah, there is, and there mainly is because of the different size of our countries.
And our armed forces, I imagine?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, the American military has more fighters on one base than we do in our entire country, you know, for example. So when you talk about American military shows, there are big differences strictly in terms of the number of aircraft you would have on static display, the number of aircraft participating in a show. This year, notwithstanding, because of the budget crunch they have down there, and that's a different topic, but I'm talking in general terms here now. The passion, the patriotism, Americans are very, very patriotic about their military. Perhaps because there are more Americans attuned in general terms to their military because of the superpower status and so on and so forth than you could say in Canada. But there's certainly equal patriotism and for those who are in the know, equal passion here in Canada. It's just that everything is a much bigger scale in the United States. As far as the rules go, they're exactly the same. So when the Snowbirds fly in the United States, or the Thunderbirds and the Blue Angels fly in Canada, we're flying under a common set of rules that have been massaged over many, many decades. And so there's no difference in that perspective. The crowds, yeah, sure, they're going to be, on average, much, much larger in the United States than they would be in Canada.
And so, you know, with this, obviously, there's international participation. Do you feel that air shows are an important part of foreign as well as public relations?
Absolutely. Absolutely, I do. And I've seen the benefits of that many times in my own personal experience flying with the snowbirds down the United States. You know, air shows are popular, and there's always going to be dignitaries at air shows. And a lot of times when the snowbirds are participating, it doesn't matter where we are, whether we're on the West Coast, whether we're in Chicago, whether we're in New York City, you're always going to have the Canadian Consulate General, for example, is always going to be there, or any other number of Canadian dignitaries, military and or civilian. So it's all part and parcel of being partners. You know, we are very much partners with the United States in NORAD, North American Air Defense Command, Aerospace Defense Command, I should say now, and NATO, North Atlantic Treaty Organization. We have been for a long, long time, since late 1940s. So we have forged a very important bond. And part of that bond is also celebrating the things that we do that are good for the public. And one of them is to entertain them with air shows, you know, with all kinds of different aircraft. Sometimes they're fighter aircraft, sometimes they're not. Same thing with the Army. You know, the Canadian Army has a tremendous team in the Skyhawks, mm-hmm. the parachute jump team. And they fulfill the same kind of role that the Snowbirds do, only, of course, they don't quite have the mobility and the number of shows that the Snowbirds might perform, but still a very important element. So I think when we go and perform in foreign countries, it's very good. I can tell you for sure, we've been invited, the Snowbirds have been invited to go and perform in Europe many times. We've been invited to go and perform in Asia many times. We've never done it because we don't have an aircraft that can fly that far, and we've never had the wherewithal to have a transport aircraft that could get them there. We do actually now, although it'd still be a big logistic exercise to move 11 aircraft, you know, via our C-17s over to Europe or to Asia. But they would do very well, and they would be extremely well received. I know that for a fact. So back in the days of the Sabres, for example, you know, we had 7 different Sabre teams. People remember the RCF Golden Hawks, but in fact, the Golden Hawks were certainly the most famous and had the most success of all of our Sabre aerobatic teams. But when we had 12 squadrons of Sabres over in Europe, there were at least 4 different aerobatic teams that flew during that time frame over there.
And flew in Europe.
Flew in all the major air shows in Europe.
And demonstrating Air Force to European public.
Sure, the RCF was there. They were there in force, and we were there in force with 12 squadrons. And even after that, during the Starfighter days, we always had a Canadian Starfighter team right up until the end of 1983, or probably mid-1983. We had a Canadian Starfighter team that went to all the major air shows. Because in Europe, you go to an air show, there'd be 200,000 people there, mm-hmm. you know.
And there'd also be all the different air forces, I imagine.
All the air forces would be represented, absolutely.
So yeah, you got to be able to represent your own.
Nice. It's one of the great aspects of being a snowbird. I've always said that several aspects. The opportunity to represent your country is obviously very, very special. That's a great honor to wear the Canadian flag on your red flying suit and fly around and do air shows to represent your country is wonderful. The opportunity to fly a very unique show that nobody else gets to fly outside of other professional military aerobatic teams is a lot of fun, a great challenge, and meeting literally thousands of people every year as the snowbirds do on the airshow circuit, that's very rewarding. So the three aspects there I've always thought were key to a guy who wanted to fly with the snowbirds.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so after talking about airshows, I'd like to just move on to some criticisms of airshows. Mm-hmm. So I'll just ask you about a few that I've encountered in my research, and then maybe just ask you for some that you know of or that you hear commonly. So one criticism I found is that air shows are criticized as being events in which military machines are promoted for the sale abroad. In your experience, how large of a part of this is of Canadian air shows?
None. Zero. You could make that argument for military air shows in the United States, because that's where your big military manufacturers are. But we don't have those military manufacturers in Canada anymore. We're not trying to sell anything. We have nothing to sell when it comes to military aircraft. Now, you will have commercial operators at air shows with booths and tents and so on and so forth, because they like air shows too, and they might be trying to sell, you know, their product, for example, Bombardier with their various numbers of executive jets. They may well be there. But in terms of Canadian air shows trying to promote military sales, zero, none.
And some peace movement publications portray air shows as glorifications of war, are turning war machines into entertainment, whereas, you know, when they're being used in a war zone, that they're weapons. So how do you feel about that?
Well, I don't agree with it. I you know, not in the Canadian example. When we go to an air show to perform, we go to entertain people. We're not going there to glorify war in any way, shape, or form. Even though we may have participated in a number of conflicts in the last couple of decades, that doesn't mean we were happy to do it. That's because our government decided that in consultation with the United Nations or NATO or any other world body, that it was in the best interests of our country to help out whatever that region might have been. But we're not there to glorify war, and we don't. We're there to entertain people. We're there to motivate people. We're there to inspire young kids to do something special with their lives. So, yeah, I hear the peace movement side of it. I just don't agree with it. I really don't. And I'd be happy to argue the point to anybody, because I've seen from both sides of the fence what the snowbirds can accomplish, both as a young kid myself, watching the Golden Hawks, watching the snowbirds when they were first formed, and how they motivated me to do something special, and the effect that I've had as a snowbird or as a Hawk 1 pilot in the last few years, being able to do the same thing for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of young kids that I've met.
And so another criticism that was brought up to me by Major General Eichel is the one, I guess we briefly touched on this, of pollution, whether it be noise, whether it be, you know, people see the smoke, and, you know, when people see smoke, they make a judgment.
Yeah, sure. You know, yeah, there's always going to be, you know, it's probably a valid comment, but I would say to you, in comparison to the other ways that we create pollution, and that we, especially pollution in the environment, this is minuscule.
Yeah.
I mean, how much pollution will a city like Vancouver or Toronto generate just from the cars, the trucks, the buses, the maritime traffic in for example, Vancouver, composed to the snowbirds doing three air shows once a year in Abbotsford? It's negligible, you know. And I think the benefits far outweigh the detriments of that. It's a valid argument in the point that, yes, is there going to be some pollution created? Yes, there will be. Is it very much? No, it's not.
And another criticism that was brought up to me was the criticism of spending. It's obviously going to come up with air shows, with the snowbirds. Why are we spending this money? You guys should be, you know, off. You're the Air Force. You should be off, you know, fighting a war somewhere. You shouldn't be flying around at home, you know.
Well, this brings into a point, a very, very important point, and that is the aspect from the Canadian Forces point of view, or the RCF point of view, of public relations and recruiting. We are living in a world, a very highly technical world, where the demographic population of young people is slowly but surely sinking. So the RCF, the Army, the Navy, we're all in a fight for the best and brightest of the young people coming out of universities. And not necessarily universities, trade schools, whatever the case may be, because, of course, we have the broad spectrum of trades and professions in the Canadian military. If you don't recruit properly, eventually you get to a point where you cannot get the right people. And if you don't have the right people, it doesn't matter how good the equipment is, you're not going to be able to man it. So I think that from the perspective of going out there and showing people what the opportunities are in the Canadian Forces, whether you want to be in the RCF or the Royal Canadian Navy or the Canadian Army, I think that's really important. And the cost of doing that, let's address the snowbirds, for example. The snowbirds have been a bargain for this country since the day they started. Even though the snowbirds fly 9 aircraft, their budget is about 1/10 of what each of the American teams spend on their teams. Even though they're only flying 6 aircraft, they're flying frontline combat fighters that are hugely expensive compared to the snowbirds. So the snowbirds are the most economical air show team of the major teams in the world flying today. Even though there's 9 airplanes, they're flying a very, very economical little Tudor jet. And they do not have a support aircraft, unlike All the American teams, the British team, the Italian team, they're all flying more high-end aircraft, all have support aircraft that have to go along with them. So I think the snowbirds are a real bargain for this country. And again, looking at it either from the military context, or from the overall context of what the snowbirds represent to Canada, and because I think the snowbirds are much, much larger now and have been for a long time than the Department of National Defense. You know, there's no accident that the snowbirds have been over every Canada Day for just about, you know, the day they were formed. They're there because they are such a symbol of national pride. So I think the expense, you know, you can argue that there's going to be a fairly large expense when we have to replace the aircraft, and that day is coming very soon. But that's a one-off shot, you know. That's a shot of about $325 million to purchase an aircraft that's going to last you for potentially another 40 years, you know, just like the snowbirds have done. I mean, good grief. The last Tudor came off the assembly line in 1966, and we're still flying it. Still flying that aircraft, and will be till 2020.
It's an impressive number.
Yeah, it is. It is very impressive.
So, saying that the cost benefits outweigh.
Absolutely. I think the snowbirds are a bargain. I really do. For all the goodwill that they achieve, and for all the goodwill and the recognition they bring to our country. Boy, oh boy, people do not appreciate how great a deal the snowbirds are to this country.
All right. So this is a good segue then into the section of questions dealing strictly with the snowbirds and your experience with them. So from a pilot's perspective and a former snowbird, what goes into becoming a snowbird in terms of time and training?
It is a total commitment. I think the biggest and most important part of being a snowbird is desire. Because without the desire, it doesn't matter how good a pilot you are, you will not be able to go the extra step to make the team once it comes to a flying tryout. The flying tryouts are extremely difficult. They're very competitive. And so desire is number one, and obviously flying skill is number two. But those are just two of the elements that go into it. And when the team selects a member for a tryout, and any Air Force pilot can apply, but when that individual is approved by their own commanding officer and eventually their name makes its way to the snowbirds, the other aspect of it is personality. And personality is really important. Never lose sight of the fact that the snowbirds are first and foremost a public relations unit. That's why they exist. The air show is a means to the end. But you need a person that's going to go out there and represent not only the Canadian Forces, because it's not an RCF team. It's a Canadian Forces team. That's a very important distinction.
Okay,
it's a Canadian Forces team, and you're representing not just the Canadian Forces. In the international context, you're representing the entire country. And the snowbirds are world famous. There's absolutely no doubt about that.
And so, does it happen then that a pilot could, you know, have the required skills and ability but not be accepted because of their personality, like these kind of attributes as well? These are all taken into account.
Yes. It not only is it possible, it has happened. You know, when you select people to try out for the snowbirds on paper, it's just that. You know, you can only go by the recommendations that come from their respective commanding officers and units. But remember that the snowbirds have to, both the air crew and the ground crew, they have to act as a team all the time. And it's really like a family. And that family has to get along, because the trust that you have to have within flying in a nine-plane formation has got to be 100% all the time. And, you know, when you're flying in that formation, you're only looking at one other airplane, and that's the guy beside you. And you have to know and trust that he is not going to do something that's going to create a safety problem in the formation. Just like for the lead, for example, is when you're doing those low-level aerobatics, the only guy looking outside at the ground is the leader. And you have to trust the leader intimately with your life, because if the leader makes a mistake, all nine guys can be dead in an instant. So trust and personality are extremely important point. And in the trial process, any of the incumbent snowbirds, unless you use, for example, that you're going to change half the team, So let's say you've got a team leader and four incumbents, and you're going to pick four new guys. Any one of those incumbents can veto one of the tryout candidates because of personality. If he feels he cannot get along with that individual, he can veto him. Now, he has to justify it, and it has to be a valid justification. But it has happened in the past where that transpired.
Okay. So I think we have had a lot of opportunities to talk about the main functions of public relations of the Snowbirds. Is there anything else you feel you've left out or haven't addressed?
Well, I would just say that when you're on the Snowbirds, it's an all-encompassing job in the sense that, you know, you're going to spend roughly 6 months of the year training, and then you're going to spend roughly 6 months of the year on the airshow circuit, give or take, you know, a couple weeks of leave in the summertime, whatever the team is doing these days. But when you go out and meet the public, you are ambassadors, you know. Anytime you're awake, you're an ambassador for the Canadian Forces. And that's a demanding role. That means that, you know, you've got to have your guard up all the time. You've got to do all the right things all the time. And it's incumbent on the team members to take care of each other on the road. And you do a lot of social functions. You do social functions both in advance and after the air show. And certainly the biggest part of all that is the autograph sessions that come after the air show. And anytime the team is performing on site at an air show, for example, say Abbotsford or Comox or wherever you happen to be, the team will do autograph session at every single show. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you'll fly a show at a remote location. For example, say they're doing a show at Chilliwack where they can't land at Chilliwack. Well, then you obviously can't do that. But that doesn't mean that you won't land wherever you are and drive back to that location to then do some public relations.
So they're obviously always expected to interact always with the public on the ground as well.
Always, always. And in many respects, you could argue that that's one of the most important things we do. It's that personal one-on-one interaction where you really, people get to realize, hey, these are just average young Canadians doing a great job of what they do. And that's the beauty of the Snowbirds, is you can go out there and show people that.
And obviously, it's not just air shows where the Snowbirds fly. So where else in your experience did you fly to promote the armed forces?
Well, I mean, outside of the Snowbirds or within the Snowbirds?
With the Snowbirds. So I'm thinking maybe like at the centennial celebrations and stuff like that.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, well, you're going to, for example, the Snowbirds, were the Snowbirds in? No, the Snowbirds weren't in Bedeck. That was the F-86. But to take, for example, major national events like the Grey Cup. Mm-hmm. The Snowbirds have been opening the Grey Cup game for many, many years. So there's always going to be fly pass, whether it be Pan American Games or Olympics or Grey Cups, any other special event, especially the events that include youth. You're always going to try, schedule permitting, to try and get the Snowbirds involved with those. The Snowbirds, where they can on the air show circuit, will do special events like, for example, visit the Children's Hospital in Toronto. That's been ongoing forever, almost since the inception of the team. That's an annual event that both the Snowbirds and all the staff in the Children's Hospital in Toronto look forward to. In my time, we did both Ottawa and Toronto, and other places as well where the schedule fit. Occasionally, you know, the team will do special presentations in the off-season where maybe the commanding officer or the team leader or one of the team coordinators will go out and be a guest speaker at any number of different banquets and that sort of stuff. We have in the past done telethons where, you know, say a telethon in Regina where the team could drive into Regina because they were just based in Moose Jaw, not far away, and participate in that sort of stuff. So anything that's good to promote a good concept, the team is always willing to do it if they can.
And you don't necessarily have to be flying every time.
No, for sure. You don't have to be. No.
So can you just explain to me how the Snowbirds differ from other demonstration teams that fly combat-capable aircraft?
Sure. It's an important distinction, and it's one that it was a decision that was made all the way back in 1967, actually, when the Golden Hawks got disbanded, unfortunately, in 1964. We didn't have an aerobatic team in 65, 66, but the decision had been made relatively early. We were trying to form another one for Canada's centennial in 1967, our 100th birthday. So they formed the Golden Centenaires. Now, the decision that time was made, conscious decision, was to use a more economical aircraft, but have a larger team. So that's when the Golden Centenaires in 1967, actually starting in September of 1966, got brand new Tudor aircraft coming right out of the Canadair plant, and they formed a 9-plane aerobatic team. Ended up with 8, unfortunately, because of an accident. But anyway, they went on the road with a core Tudor team of 8 aircraft. The beauty of the Snowbirds and the Snowbird show and the Golden Centenaire show was really modeled in many respects after the type of shows that were flown in Europe, where they had bigger teams but not necessarily frontline combat aircraft. The beauty of that, of course, with 9 airplanes like the Snowbirds fly now, is you have a bigger bag of tricks. Your choreography can be much tighter and staged in front of, you can have something going on in front of the crowd all the time. That's a big advantage. They tend to be a little bit less noisy, even though there may be 9 aircraft as opposed to, say, 6 F-18s, which can be very noisy, or 6 F-16s in the case of the Thunderbirds. So the Thunderbirds and the Blue Angels and those teams, like the Russian team, for example, the Chinese teams, which use frontline fighters, are very much power shows. But they are trying to project a power image because of who they are. They are, you know, in this case, the United States, they're a superpower. So you'll never see them going, I don't think, to anything other than a frontline fighter type of operation. Those shows are impressive as well, but I think that in both cases you need a lot of skill. It's a PR job still, but you're going to have a lot of power and noise in the case of the American teams, whereas in Canada you're going to have more of a graceful ballet with the Snowbirds.
So in your book, Tradition of Excellence, you suggest that the Snowbirds be replaced by the Hawk, which is another trainer. But obviously you offer a lot of reasons for this, why the CF-18 wouldn't be prudent or affordable, I guess, in that case.
Right.
But, you know, if hypothetically, if it were possible, would you like to see a Canadian demonstration team with combat-capable aircraft?
Well, I think the important thing is first of all, whatever aircraft replaces the Tudor for the Snowbirds, in my mind, has to be a jet airplane. Okay? That's number one criteria. Number two, highly desirable that you maintain the 9 aircraft show for which the Snowbirds have become so famous over the last 42 years. And remembering that this aircraft won't come, the earliest this aircraft will come will be about 2020, 2021. So the team will have been flying the Tudor for over 50 years. Okay? And now, if someone could magically say, okay, all costs are off, here's 9 F-18s to do a show, the Snowbirds would do a fantastic show with the F-18. Because the F-18, unlike some other previous fighters that have flown, for example, the American teams, can actually fly quite slow in front of the crowd, can keep the show quite tight. And with that 9 aircraft, you'd have tremendous choreography and so on and so forth. So sure, I mean, that would be great, but that's never going to happen. That's not even theoretically possible because of the cost. Mm-hmm. You know, you're flying an aircraft that burns, God, probably 4 times as much fuel. In fact, probably more than that in terms of the comparison between what an aircraft like the Tudor will fly as opposed to an airplane like the F-18. There's no comparison in the amount of fuel that each aircraft is going to burn. Mm-hmm. But if you go back to the Hawk, and the Hawk is sort of a limited combat aircraft in the sense that there are versions of the Hawk which are combat aircraft. The reason that I recommended the Hawk in my book was simply because of the fact that 2 reasons. Number one, it's been flying with the Royal Air Force Red Arrows since 1980. It's a proven aerobatic performer and they have a beautiful show. But number two, most importantly, is that happens to be the aircraft that we've been using as an advanced jet trainer since 2000. Now, bearing in mind that my book came out, the first edition of my book came out in 2002, that was the natural successor to the Tudor for the Snowbirds. We're now in a phase where what we had hoped would happen would be that the Tudor would have been replaced by now has not happened. So the aircraft that hopefully will replace the Tudor will be whatever aircraft replaces the Hawk. So we may have missed the opportunity. In fact, I think we have missed the opportunity to use the Hawk as our aerobatic team aircraft. And whatever team whatever aircraft comes after that, in terms of an advanced jet trainer, would be the one in theory. So we'll see.
Also in your book, A Tradition of Excellence, you stress the importance of the snowbird struggle to exist and Canadian demonstration teams, you know, who are always under threat of disbandment. Do you feel that today they're still always under the threat of disbandment?
I think that any time you have a country that is running a deficit, and if you have people that do not understand the merits of a national aerobatic team, there's always going to be a threat. I don't think the threat is that great right now, because I could give you quotes from probably the last 6 or 7 prime ministers and or ministers of national defense who have all lauded the snowbirds for what they do. I mean, just in Prime Minister Harper's time, for example, in the last couple of years, and this goes back probably 3 or 4 years ago now, the snowbirds were in Parliament. They were on Parliament Hill. They were introduced in Parliament to a standing ovation by all parties. So I really believe that the government of the day and the members of Parliament, for the most part, really understand the importance of having a national aerobatic team and what they do for Canada.
And so they become an actual part of our heritage now.
I wrote a paper way back when I was in staff college in 1987. And the topic of that paper was the Canadian Forces Snowbirds, the Canadian Snowbirds, an integral component of the Canadian Forces. I really do think they're an integral component. I think they're absolutely fundamental to where we want to go in the future in terms of public relations and recruiting for the Canadian military. You have to have a body out there to interact with the Canadian public. And the snowbirds, make no doubt about it, the snowbirds are the public face of the Canadian Forces. There's no other unit in the history of our country that has ever had more face time with the Canadian public than the Canadian snowbirds, Canadian Forces snowbirds.
Do you feel they have a bright future in front of them?
I think the future is bright if the government and successive commanders of the military and ministers of national defense go through with their commitment to eventually get the team a new jet aircraft. I mean, you cannot fly the same airplane forever. There are issues that you have to be concerned about, structural integrity being the principal one. But as long as they can maintain the Tudor and ensure that it's safe from a structural integrity point of view, in theory, they could go for a long, long time. Right now, the plan is 2020. Yeah.
That's an incredible amount of time, I think, for it to keep flying.
It is. It is incredible. No other country in the world has ever asked their national aerobatic team to fly the same aircraft for so long. And I think that's a testament to the personnel, the maintenance teams that have monitored and made sure the aircraft was safe to fly for a long, long time. And will continue to do so as long as they have to.
Yes, as well as a testament to the Tudor, I imagine.
It is. It's a great testament to the airplane. It's a wonderful little airplane. I got over 2,000 hours on it, for sure. It's a beautiful airplane. I think it's the best basic jet trainer that was ever built. I wish we hadn't retired it, and we did. But that was for other budgetary reasons that they had to do that. So.
All right. We're running out of time, I guess. So if you could give me a quick statement on how you feel about the current F-35 procurement debate.
Let me back up, if I may, because there was another question in there, and I just want to give you an example of some public relations things that I was exposed to in my time in the snowbirds, if I may.
So can you share some personal anecdotes about your time with the snowbirds that involve PR duties?
Absolutely. And I could give you many, many examples, but there's a couple I want to give you. I'll give you an example, a couple examples from my first year in the team, when I thought I had the greatest job in the whole world, and I'd made the snowbirds as Snowbird 9. A couple examples that year which are really interesting, and then I'll give you another one from my last year in the team, leading the team in 1990, so 10 years apart. As you may recall, and this has been in the news, or at least in the movie theaters recently, with respect to Canada's involvement in rescuing the American hostages back in 1980, early in 1980. Well, On the 25th and 26th of May, 1980, the Snowbirds, for the very first time in our history, went to New York City. And we performed two air shows in New York City and also went to a public relations event and also did a press ride that made national news in the United States. And it was not only because the Snowbirds were there for the first time, it was because of the fact that we had got such credit for helping these the Americans in Tehran. Mm-hmm. So the first day, first air show we flew on the 26th of May, 1980, there was 900,000 people in one day. Wow. The second show was 1.2 million. So in 2 days, for the first time in Snowbird history, we had 2 million Americans watch our air show. That was unbelievable. We went and had dinner with Ken Taylor, the ambassador, who was by this time now back, of course, in Canada, in the United States. He was the, at that time, he'd become the American ambassador. When we walked into a restaurant, he was immediately recognized by the patrons in the restaurant. A standing ovation, right there. One man, one Canadian, generated standing ovation. And I thought to myself, this is fantastic. And we were all, at that time, we dressed in red blazers, red and blue for the pilots and the ground crew respectively. And to be part of this just showed me what tremendous respect the Americans had for Canadians. Well, going forward a month later, we were doing the air show in Kansas City at Richards Gabar Air Force Base. And they had something like 100,000 stickers made up with American and Canadian flag crossed called Operation Handshake. And it said, thank you for helping us in Tehran. And we on the Snowbirds were the benefactors of that. But again, first time we performed at that location. And it was fantastic, the reception that we got as Canadians and as Snowbirds down there. They absolutely loved the show. When we opened our canopies after that show, it was a roar like I've never heard before in my life. It was just fantastic. So there's two examples where, you know, Canadians were so highly respected down in the United States. Now I'll give you a Canadian example, which really warmed my heart when I was leading the team in 1990. We'd done a film that we filmed all through 1990 because it was the 20th anniversary of the Snowbirds, and it was called Those Magnificent Snowbirds. And I referred to this earlier prior to our interview that movie, documentary, went around the world. Well, in 1990, we had arranged, David Foster, a very famous music producer, had written a song for the Snowbirds called Flight of the Snowbirds. And he had actually had a documentary of the Snowbirds back in 1986. So we had arranged that David Foster was going to be playing for Canada Day on Parliament Hill that night, and that the Snowbirds would come out unannounced to the crowd. And there was about 100,000 people in the crowd that day because of David Foster. Well, that was televised nationally. And when we walked out onto that stage with David playing in Flight of the Snowbirds, and they had the big screens up projecting images that we had just filmed for our movie, again, the reception was just unbelievable. So those are just a couple of very small examples of the rewards that I had seen as a snowbird pilot representing Canada, and how much both on both sides of the border, how much the snowbirds were respected and admired and so on and so forth. And I just thought I wanted to share those with you because they're great examples.
Yeah, definitely. So, well, with that, so anything else you'd like to share? Any other stories, information, opinions, anything about air shows you feel we've missed?
I would just reiterate by saying that I think the Snowbirds are absolutely vital to the Canadian Forces and to the RCF. I think they are really a part of our national fabric and have been for a long, long time. I think the fact that they exist is important for the country and not just for the Canadian Forces. And certainly everywhere I've gone, both Canada and United States, and I've done probably about 240 shows, 250 shows with the Snowbirds, but I've been at dozens and dozens more. Everywhere I've gone, the Snowbirds have been applauded for their skill and their professionalism and what they do for our country. So, and I feel pretty strongly about it.
I'm sure. And so, if we can, quickly, your opinion on the F-35, just because we have talked about it.
Yeah, the F-35, I think the F-35 situation is unfortunate. I think a lot of it has been media-generated. Okay, there are two aspects to the F-35 scenario as far as I'm concerned. First of all, when the Liberal government, and it was the Liberal government, not the Conservative government, the first agreed to get involved with the F-35 project, the reason for that was because the F-35, which had been chosen in a competition between two major manufacturers of the United States, was going to be, in theory at least, the best fighter aircraft in the world. And a lot of the allies, Canada included, were very interested in being part of that process because that was the future of fighter aviation. So that's why we got involved. Subsequent to that, as we put more money into the program, obviously, part of the issue has become that, like any new aircraft, especially a highly technological aircraft like the F-35, there's always going to be growing pains. Well, I think the fact that there have been growing pains has been grossly blown out of proportion for political reasons. And sure, could some things have been done differently? Maybe. But the people that I happen to know, some of the people that worked in the F-35 office that were responsible for eventually selecting that aircraft, they're good people. And they did what they thought was right for the betterment of the Canadian forces and for the pilots that are going to fly that aircraft potentially into combat. And there's no question that the F-35 will be one of the best fighter aircraft in the world. No doubt about it. Okay, the days of, you know, dogfighting are long gone. Okay, this F-35 will kill adversaries before they ever even become visual. Okay, it has that amount of sophistication in the aircraft and in the sensors. It's called sensor fusion, that will provide the pilot with all kinds of stuff. For example, the pilot will no longer need an AWACS, the airborne aircraft with the big dish. All that information that he might have got from AWACS, he will get directly from other sensors. Okay, so it gives him unparalleled situation awareness. Now, so contrast that now with the cost. And herein lies the problem, is the cost. The cost of the aircraft has escalated significantly and will continue to escalate probably until, you know, they get the growing pains ironed out, if you will, some of the technological challenges, and there are some for sure. So where we have to make a decision in our country is, can we afford the aircraft? And I would start off by saying that as far as I'm concerned personally, 65 aircraft is not enough. For a country the size of Canada, 65 aircraft, especially if you're going to make those aircraft available for deployment, you know, to a world conflict somewhere where you're going to take any number of those aircraft away, and then you still want to cover all of Canada's airspace and so on and so forth.
How big is the CF-18 fleet?
CF-18 fleet?
Yeah, yeah.
We bought 138 CF-18s. When we retrofitted and did the latest upgrade to the F-18 in the last few years, we only did 80 aircraft. Subsequent to that, I believe two have crashed. We're down to 78. Okay, and that includes only two operational squadrons. Okay, and an operational training unit in Cold Lake. So you've got two squadrons in Cold Lake, one of which is the training squadron, and in Bagotville you've got one other. Put this in perspective to when I left the Air Force, we had 12 fighter squadrons, okay, including the training squadrons, but that would have been one, two, three, we would have had 9 operational squadrons, okay? We now have 2 operational squadrons, okay? We are very small. And, you know, sophistication is one thing for sure, but I still think that quantity does matter, and when you have only 65 aircraft, that's not very many. But that 65 was driven strictly by cost. Now that the cost is really escalating, that then brings in the question of, can we afford 65 aircraft? And if the answer to that is we can't afford 65 F-35s, then probably you do have to say, okay, what's the next best option? Well, the next best option in my mind is the F-18 Super Hornet. So that's where you may find the final decision going. But in terms of the representation of what the work was done by the Canadian forces and by the Canadian fighter pilots who were involved with that initial selection, to me, it's above reproach. It really is. They were going, as were so many of our other allies, for the best aircraft available that to put our pilots in that are going to go into harm's way. And I think that was a valid argument. Unfortunately, Lockheed Martin has not been able to keep the cost down to a more reasonable level, and that's why we have the debate right now.
When it comes to cost, I imagine it's very easy for the media to prey on that, or to...
Of course it is. Of course it is. And that, to me, has been the most disappointing part of all of this, is that the opposition parties and the media have just pounced on all the negatives about the aircraft and about the cost in particular, and the way that the aircraft has costed, which has never been done that way before. So anyway, that's my take on the F-35.
All right, no, it's been great. I'm glad we got to talk about that a bit. I think it's something that could be proved to be very relevant and very valuable, any kind of opinions or information on this in terms of history, whether it be 5 years, 10 years, however long down the road, because, you know, that's when we're going to be looking back at this debate.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see where it goes. I am a strong believer in keeping the purchase in North America. The United States are our closest allies, and if we can get a good product that's going to keep our guys safe and relevant when they go into combat, then I'd much rather keep it in North America. We have a very bad example with the submarines that we bought from Europe that have not worked out very well, and we don't want to repeat that exercise.
All right. I just ask again if there's anything else you'd like to share.
No, I think that's I think that pretty much covers it, Luke. I think that's been a good overview of public relations in the Canadian Forces, and it's been a pleasure.
Right. Okay. So this concludes the Military Oral History Program interview with Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Dempsey on March 18th, 2013. And Mr. Dempsey, just to reaffirm that you have had a copy of the interview release form, and we have both signed it.
Affirm. Yep. For sure.
Okay, and with that, thank you very much for participating. It's been a great experience.
Pleasure. Okay, thank you.